This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota and our streaming Main Street all around the world this time of day. And today we're going to start our show talking about a new technology for flare mitigation. This is an intriguing idea that was presented to an interim committee on energy and transportation recently at the North Dakota Capitol. Cully Kavnis is the founder and president of Crusoe Energy Systems. He joins us by phone. Cully, thanks for being with us today.
Well, Doug, thanks so much for having me on the show today, and it's great to be able to share this message with yourself and your listeners on Main Street.
Well, what is digital flare mitigation?
So digital flare mitigation is a new technology that we've developed at Crusoe Energy Systems for reducing the amount of natural gas that is burned in the oil field due to a lack of access to pipelines, either because the pipelines are too full and they can't accept more gas, or because there aren't pipelines at a specific oil and gas production site. So what we do is we bring in energy-intensive data centers, actual modular mobile data centers. They look basically like a shipping container. And we set those right at the wellhead, right on the production site. We do some gas piping work to connect the gas that was being flared into power generation equipment that's also on site. And then that electricity generated from the natural gas as fuel, we use that electricity in our data centers. And so we actually basically bring mobile data centers to the oil field to consume all of the stranded energy, which is a real issue in North Dakota. As I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar, the state and our country, we burn a lot of natural gas because of these infrastructure constraints. In the United States, we burn more than 1 billion cubic feet of natural gas per day because of this issue, which we call stranded gas in the industry. And it's a function of there not being sufficient infrastructure for the gas at the time that a well is drilled. So we're trying to really tackle that problem. North Dakota is a state where there is a lot of flaring. It's about 400,000 to 500,000 cubic feet per day. And it's a challenge that we hope to be able to confront with a new technology.
So does your company then provide the generator as well?
Yeah, we bring the whole solution to the operator. We make it very simple for the operator. We bring the generator and the mobile data center. The whole system can actually be set up in just a matter of days. So whereas it can take, you know, years to permit and finance and build a pipeline and secure right-of-way, all those complicated aspects with physical infrastructure, we can deliver a solution for a large-scale amount of gas, up to millions of cubic feet per day, in a matter of days once all of the orders are sort of filled and our supply chain is run its course. We bring everything to the site, and really all the operator sees is some piping work and some electrical work.
So these commodities, they provide the natural gas, the driller. You convert that natural gas into electricity. I assume the well site needs some power too, and then your servers, this modular server farm that you bring on site, is drawing the rest of the power. And if it all works okay, then you don't have to flare, right?
You got it. That's exactly right. We like to say it's easier to send a bit than to send a molecule, and that's really true. The beauty of modern communications technology is that we can transmit large amounts of information and data really over the air. We can use satellite internet and other forms of remote networking technology to connect places like rural areas of North Dakota right into the major mainstream information technology infrastructure that we use throughout the country and throughout the world. And so our view is that why should we suffer with this issue of flaring natural gas in places like North Dakota, West Texas, Wyoming? My home state is Colorado. I'm from Denver, and I used to be in the upstream oil and gas industry and have encountered the struggles of flaring head on as a producer. And so our view is, why does the industry have to wrestle with this when we have this abundant form of, frankly, wasted energy that could be used for something valuable? And why not bring a piece of the digital economy into the oil field and let a part of the oil field do some work that contributes to and benefits the digital economy? And we think it fits together really naturally, and we're having some good early success with it. We've got 8 of these systems in operation today. And some of them are in North Dakota. We have others in Wyoming and Colorado. And that's really what we're working on here at Crusoe Energy Systems.
Well, what are the features in North Dakota's oil patch that make it suitable for your proposal?
Well, North Dakota is a great market for us. On the one hand, it's because the challenge of flaring is large in North Dakota. There is a lot of flaring, so there is just a big opportunity to help and to be a part of the solution there. But also in North Dakota, there are regulatory incentives for companies to not flare. The state has tried to get ahead of this issue and implement some regulations and rules that would mitigate the amount of gas being flared. And so there is a reason for operators to want to find a solution to flaring. In some other states, you have a situation where there really is no rule against flaring or it's not really enforced. And so in those cases, it's a little bit easier for operators to maybe look the other way if they have a flaring issue. North Dakota is trying to do the right thing. They're trying to be proactive. At the same time, they're a very pro-oil and gas state. So there is, like I said, a lot of upstream activity. There are a lot of new wells being brought on, and sometimes those are in areas where the midstream infrastructure, that pipeline infrastructure, is not fully developed or built out enough to accept all the new gas volumes. And so that is what kind of creates a flaring situation that we might be helpful in. And we see that formula over and over again in North Dakota.
So I'm clear here. How does this benefit the energy producer monetarily? I mean, what's the win-win here? Does your company, by using that gas, which would otherwise have to be flared, help the company stay in compliance? Or is there actual money that changes hands here?
Yeah, so the number one benefit for the oil and gas company is, in a formation like the Bakken, the economics are primarily driven by the liquids. So the oil and condensate are the value drivers for that well. That's where most of the revenue is coming from. And if they find themselves in a situation where they're flaring so much gas that they're breaking the rules, then they have to actually curtail the amount of oil being produced from that well or even shut the well off in total. And so in that situation, there's a big investment that's been made and then no revenue coming out of it from oil. So our main value add is to help the operator make sure that doesn't happen, help them continue producing at maximum oil production rates that they can achieve with that well while being in regulatory compliance and not flaring volumes that are going to be in excess of the allowances that the state provides. There also are some environmental benefits that come from our system because the gas is being burned through a generator that has a catalytic converter. It's reducing significantly volatile organic compounds, which are called VOCs, that's the acronym, carbon monoxide, nitrous oxide. Also, because a flare doesn't always burn 100% of the methane, you're actually also reducing methane emissions. So for the local community, you have a better emissions profile from oil and gas production. You have the oil production volumes being maintained. So that's big for royalties, making sure that those state taxes and landowner royalties are being paid on the oil and that that's being maximized. That's great for the local community. And then all those things are also great for the operator. Maintain regulatory compliance and maintain revenue.
Kelly Kavnis is the founder and president of Crusoe Energy Systems. We're talking about a new technology for flare mitigation, which uses natural gas at a well site to power a generator to power basically a server farm. Let's talk about the other part of this, Kelly, the need for data. We're moving to 5G on our cell phones and everything and more of everything is being done online these days. So there's a demand there too, right?
There's a huge demand for energy, for computing, and for the processing of data, and it's growing every day. You mentioned a few of them just now. 5G is one. Imagine this. Imagine all of these new modern electric vehicles and combustion vehicles that have cameras and sensors all over the vehicles, and some of them are equipped with self-driving. The amount of data being produced from one of those vehicles is enormous, and it's rich data. I mean, it's images, it's video. Things have to be interpreted and analyzed in a server farm, a data center environment somewhere, somehow. And that's just one example of many, many examples. We're starting to get into the realm of virtual reality, augmented reality, artificial intelligence, machine learning, blockchain. all these things are very energy intensive. They can be very energy intensive forms of computation. So the challenge that the tech industry faces is just mounting bills and a huge line item for data center and data center infrastructure and powering those data centers. And so again, our vision here is one problem solves the other. On the tech side, they're looking for ways to manage their cost of energy and have access to abundant energy and reliable forms of energy. And on the energy producer side of things, they're looking for ways to dispose of energy. Essentially, they're producing too much at a point that doesn't have infrastructure to handle it, and so they have a waste situation. And so we think that bringing the two together is a really elegant solution. And again, that's what we've been developing here at Crusoe.
So do you sell the server time, or is there a broker? Does somebody else sell it? What kinds of tasks might these servers be doing? You mentioned some data needs that are out there.
Yeah, so it's a great question. One of the most exciting applications that we're really looking forward to is going to be our, which is still in the prototype stage, but we're developing it, and I think it'll be something really exciting for the industry. Is a system that can actually provide artificial intelligence model training. So this is right at the cutting edge of technology. My co-founder, Chase Lockmiller, he's very brilliant when it comes to computer technology. He has a master's degree from Stanford in computer science, and before that studied his undergrad at MIT. So he's really bright technically, and we have a great team around him in terms of software developers, and they're developing a product where essentially we can rent out server time to researchers and entrepreneurs and companies that are involved in machine learning and artificial intelligence. And typically what this looks like is a huge, huge data set that needs to be analyzed every which way. And it's a process that can take days, weeks, or even months to analyze and correlate all the different data points within one of these large data sets. So that's just a ripe opportunity for, again, energy-intensive computing, which we think we can place into the oil field.
Is all of this off-the-shelf technology? Are there any unique patents or processes involved here?
We have developed a lot of our own intellectual property, that's for sure. A lot of the engineering and design and implementation behind the data centers, the way that we connect them into the power generation equipment, the way that we connect into the remote networking, you know, the wireless networking. There are just a bunch of different pieces that we've had to optimize or troubleshoot or problem solve around. And at this point, we've gotten really pretty good at, like I said, deploying these things quickly and efficiently. A big thing for us is also safety. So we've invested hugely into making these systems as safe as possible. That's a big part of the engineering process and the operational process. We've talked a lot about the technology side, but half of Crusoe is oil and gas professionals. So we've got petroleum engineers, we've got electrical professionals, we've got people who used to work on fracking crews. Myself, I'm a geologist originally. Our vice president of business development, he used to be a landman from the oil and gas industry. So it's really a unique combination where we're bringing sort of top flight software development talent typically from the West Coast. We're recruiting people from big tech companies and out of some of the top university programs. And we're bringing those people together with really experienced oil and gas professionals. And the combined team is just something that I think is very unique.
Well, the problem you describe is not unique to the Bakken or, for that matter, the Permian. There's fracking going on in lots of places these days and other kinds of oil and gas extraction. So isn't this potentially a competitive thing? I mean, the whole world might need something like this.
You know, I think you're onto it. Exactly. It's a huge problem. The United States is just one piece of a much larger flaring challenge. In fact, the World Bank has elevated flaring as one of their highlighted priorities on a global basis, is to end flaring by 2030. All the producers worldwide would love to find a solution for the gas that they're otherwise wasting. Communities would love to find any alternative to a big, bright ball of fire in the sky at night and sort of an inefficient, dirty combustion process, which flaring is generally not the best way to burn the gas. So I think you're right. There are a bunch of factors here, and it's much bigger than the Bakken. It's much bigger than North Dakota. Like I said, North Dakota has been a really great initial market for us and a place where we found some traction. Some other places have been Wyoming, Colorado, Montana. We're having some conversations with companies in Texas. So there's a big world out there, and we do hope to solve the problem on a big scale. But it's always one step at a time.
Well, it's relatively new now. You've got a few installations in the state and elsewhere. Is it a hard sell? Are people coming to you?
You know, at first, it was a hard sell because when it's brand new and nobody's ever heard of it before, that's a challenge. As an entrepreneur, that's always a challenge. And actually, the first one we built in Wyoming. And it's before we had a big team. Really, it was my partner, Chase, and myself, and a few friends of the company, and some contractors that we were able to find, and a company, a local, small, privately held company, who was willing to take a shot with us. And we asked for the opportunity to prove to them that this could work and that this could reduce their amount of natural gas that they were flaring. And they said, you know what, we'd like to give it a chance. Like to give it a shot, and so we went ahead and we designed and engineered and fabricated, delivered, and installed this system. And this was about a year ago now. This was last December in the middle of that bomb cyclone winter. And so I remember standing out there in the field, negative 13 degrees, and we were commissioning this thing for the first time. And when it fired up, and you could watch the flare reduce in size as the servers came online. And we all saw that this really was going to work. We just started celebrating right there in the field. It was a really great moment. And it's gotten easier since then because every time there's one, you know, they hear about their competitors using it or their neighbors using it, and we can go show them a tour and show them that it's not so science fiction after all. It really does work. I think it does get easier as you build more and deploy more into the field.
How many people would your company have on an installation like this?
Well, there's a burst of activity right when we set the equipment and install it, and we could have anywhere up to maybe a dozen people involved at a single installation site. That's a, you know, it's there are people that are operating cranes. Obviously, trucks are coming and going. We've got electricians, roustabouts that are doing plumbing and piping work.
But that's only for about a week or so, isn't it? Do you need people there when it's actually operating?
You know, you're exactly right. Once it's set and operating, then it is a lower labor intensity operation. We will always have local people that we're employing, either contractors or some of our own folks, but it's more of like a daily check-in type of thing rather than a constant operation.
Is this something that's ultimately quite portable? If it takes a week to set it up or maybe just a few days to take it down, does that mean you can move from well site to well site as the need or opportunity arises?
Yes, exactly. We've already actually done two remobilizations, one in Colorado and one in Wyoming. And it was just like you mentioned, just a couple days. We packed it up. We brought a crane, put it on a flatbed, drive to the next site, and then the same process in reverse.
So are you requesting any legislative or regulatory action in North Dakota to better facilitate getting this onto well sites?
We've tried to be very non-controversial and not get too involved in local politics. We know that, you know, there's a lot of background there that, and we're just newcomers, so we haven't inserted ourselves into any of that yet. What we have done is we have offered to provide sort of informational presentations. Sometimes a government body like a regulatory body or the state senate will hear about us and they'll ask for us to come in and share more about what we're doing. We think that's smart just to make sure that everybody's aware and sort of part of the process, part of the conversation. So we've done that several times. We don't have any specific asks or requests on the legislative front, though.
Natural gas can vary from well to well. Would your system operate with those kinds of variations?
Yeah, it's designed specifically for the raw gas coming out of the well. The gas will go through a separator on site, which would remove any freestanding liquids from the gas stream. But we are set up to handle what they call rich gas, which has a higher BTU content, basically more energy per volume of gas. So we're operating with gas that has, you know, elevated amount of propane or butane, and we're selecting and designing our engines on the generator side around that rich gas. So basically in all of our projects, we are using that high BTU content gas, and that is a real selling point because the operator doesn't have to do any kind of elaborate like gas treating before they supply the fuel to us.
As you mentioned, the state is sensitive about flaring issues and has set standards that it wants producers to reach. Those standards need to be looked at, though, in if you're pumping 1.5 million barrels a day as opposed to 1 million barrels a day, 12% flaring can be a lot of flaring. So if you were looking at full implementation of this kind of technology in the Bakken, would we see flaring?
You would see a dramatic reduction in flaring. If we scaled this up and were able to deploy this technology to all of the wells that are flaring currently, we believe we can knock flaring down well below the goals that the state has. You know, you asked about do we have a request or some kind of a legislative idea, and I said no. And part of the reason why I don't think it's required that we push on that is because I think the state is going in the right direction already. Just some of the sessions that I have attended on those informational presentations that I mentioned, it's very clear that the state senators and the NDIC, they take flaring very seriously, and they're trying to, on the one hand, work with operators to make sure that they don't, you know, harm the industry, but they are pushing that this isn't going to be the kind of thing where you don't have to follow the rules that we've set forth. These rules are real, and we're trying to find creative solutions to help you comply with those rules. But the state has sort of set out an expectation that flaring gradually gets reduced. And I think now it's about to go from 88% gas capture to 91% gas capture. So it's just another example of the state is sort of rolling out progressively stricter rules on flaring. And we see that that's going in the right direction, and that's a great initiative for the state to take. And we think that we can be really helpful in that process by going after those wells that are hard to connect to pipe and providing a new solution there.
Well, you've been in operation for about a year. So when you look down the road, 5-10 years, where do you see Crusoe Energy Systems?
So we see ourselves as not just being a major flaring solution for the oil and gas industry, but being a major participant in the technology industry also. We think we can bring just a new level of capacity and a new level of capabilities to the distributed computing industry, which is sort of at the cutting edge of what's going on in technology today. We want to be a part of that and be a growing part of that over time. In the oil and gas industry, we think we can scale this up to be a really meaningful impact on flaring. You know, like you mentioned today, we are still a relatively young company, although we're growing very quickly. We expect to have more than 30 systems deployed by June of next year, so within basically 6 months. So we're sort of on this very, very upward trajectory when it comes to the scale-up of our operations. And if we play that out over 5 years, we don't see any reason why this can't be making major tens of millions of cubic feet of flare gas reductions across multiple basins, adding up to really big numbers that move the needle on our country's flaring challenge.
Cully Kavnis is the founder and president of Crusoe Energy Systems. You can find out more information at crusoeenergy.com. Crusoe is C-R-U-S-O-E, energy.com. Cully, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thanks so much for the time, and thanks to all of your listeners who tuned in. And again, just a pleasure to be in North Dakota and have a chance to speak with you today. Thank you.
You're welcome. Still to come on Main Street, helping inmates return to society. First, the news.
Good afternoon from the Prairie Public Newsroom. I'm Todd McDonald.
I'm so proud to be able to be called the president of the University of North Dakota.
Dr. Andrew Armacost has been hired as UND's new president. He was chosen by the State Board of Higher Education. Armacost is the dean of faculty at the Air Force Academy. He says he has spent a considerable amount of time on the campus talking to students, faculty, and staff, and says he finds there's a lot of love for North Dakota and for UND. He says he's honored to take the helm.
And to really continue to propel it in a direction that will take the university far. Growth in research, growth in educational programs, growth in a sense of community. These are all factors that really will focus on immediately when I step on campus.
Armacost says he plans to be on the job by June 1st of 2020 or earlier if possible. A Newtown construction firm has been fined $4,600 for violating North Dakota's Call Before You Dig law. The owners of Arrow Pipeline filed a complaint against Diamond Willow Energy, LLC, for not following that law. Public Service Commission Chairman Brian Crosius says Diamond Willow was working on a project on the Fort Berthold Reservation.
They failed to contact the notification center and provide an excavation notice or location notice before beginning an excavation.
Krasha says as a result, the company hid both an 8-inch crude oil pipeline and a 6-inch natural gas pipeline, and that affected protective coating on those two pipelines.
And that's a protective coating that is put on the pipes in order to ensure that they maintain integrity, their integrity while being placed underground or when located underground. It essentially prevents that they would deteriorate over time, so that protective coating is incredibly important.
The cost to replace that coating was nearly $71,000. Commissioner Julie Fedorchuk says Diamond Willow had to pay for those damages.
This gets to be a really costly problem for companies who just don't take the extra step, plan ahead a little bit, and do the proper notification and careful digging. So really, it's not a way to save time or money.
Krasha says Diamond Willow is a first-time offender. He says the company was easy to work with in drafting the order. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
Dakota Stage of Bismarck presents A Christmas Carol, December 5th through the 7th and 12th through the 14th at 7:30 p.m. and December 15th at 2 p.m. This adaptation of Charles Dickens' Christmas story is lovingly retold in an innovative and relevant way. As charming as ever, A Christmas Carol reminds us of the importance of finding our humanity and that it is never too late to seek redemption. Musical and merry, heartfelt and magical, A Christmas Carol, brought to you by Dakota Stage in Bismarck. More information and tickets available at dakotastageltd.com or by phone at 701-258-4998.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio now by Leonard Wells. He is a reentry peer support person. He's also the housing director, care coordinator, jack of all trades for the F5 project in Fargo. Thanks for joining us, Leonard.
Thanks for having me.
And with you, Jen Troska. She's the director of development for F5. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's get right into it, Leonard. What is the F5 project?
F5 project. We are nonprofit organization that was founded by a guy that wanted to do something different for men and women coming out of institutions, jails, correctional facilities, treatment, you name it. So what he did was he wanted to start a program with guys. We can meet somebody where they at. We want to be a service to somebody. So what we did was we started taking our meetings into the jails. And from going into jails, meeting guys, having them give them a call when you get released from jail, but we had nowhere to take them to. So what he did was he said, I'm going to try something different. He developed open houses where guys can relieve the level of stress by residing in a house. So now what we do is we help guys find housing, and we also help them find employment. Throughout that past, a little bit past that, we also help guys in recovery as well, far as finding treatment, getting into treatment, any type of assistance we can be a service to somebody in the community. That's what F5 is.
Now, Adam Martin, the fellow who started F5, came out of prison. And you came out of prison.
Yes.
Tell us your story.
My story is long, man. I was raised in Chicago. I was born in Chicago, moved to Minneapolis at a young age with my family. But I grew up around a life of crime. I grew up in a house where it was alcohol, a lot of alcohol being drunk, and my dad was an addict, a heroin addict. So I had two brothers, and my oldest brother was already incarcerated by the time we moved to Minnesota. So what I did was I started being in the street. And with being in the street, I got everything that came with it, incarceration and things like that. So it was a long story. It was a long struggle. I ended up doing I've been in prison 5 times. My last prison sentence was 13 and a half years, so I served 10 years. I am a father of 3, so I was 10 years I was missing out of my kid's life. Wow.
So what do you think turned Leonard around?
you know, I had to quit being selfish and realize that life was more, not only about me, it was more about others that love me too. Because I had to realize every time that I'm incarcerated and going to jail, they're incarcerated too. So I'm constantly, continuously hurting the loved ones that I got on my corner. So I had to try something different, and I wanted to do something different, not only for myself, but for my kids as well.
So how long have you been with F5?
I've been with F5 almost 2 years now. I started volunteering, going to speak in the jail, just sharing my story, encouraging the men and women up in there, like, hey, change is possible. You can do it. And one of the biggest things I wanted to do was encourage them to ask for the help. You know, because that's how I had to realize. I realized that I couldn't do it on my own. So I reached out to some people that I knew that had my best interests at heart as well. And I asked for help, and here I am today.
Jen, this is the time of year when lots of organizations are out asking people for help.
Yes.
You know, it's the holiday season, and hopefully people are in the giving mood. What is the ask for F5? How receptive are people to this cause?
I've only been there about 2 months, but the people that I've talked to, I've had a lot of different meetings with people. I've walked into businesses, talked to people. Everyone's very excited. I would say, 85% of people have heard of F5. If they haven't, they've seen it somewhere and they know a little bit about it. So it's really easy to get in and, you know, kind of tell them what we're doing and give them a couple, you know, different success stories. Recently, we just published an article in the Season of Caring catalog about one of our participants, and that really helped get the word out. Everyone that I've talked to has been very excited and they like what we're doing. You know, these are our neighbors, our friends, our brothers. Yeah, everyone's just been very open to it.
And you have a big fundraiser coming up in January.
Yes, we absolutely do. We have our opportunity ball coming up in January, January 12th, and that's going to be held at the Avalon.
And how can people find out more about it?
Absolutely. If you check out our website, f5project.org, there's a link on there to our opportunity ball. And we're still currently looking for silent auction donations, any kind of, you know, sponsorship. We have different sponsorship levels available, and any kind of donations, basically, just to help us get it up and running and have a good event.
So it's coming up January 12th at the Avalon in Fargo.
Yes. Yep.
All right. Bernard, how do people qualify for F5 help? Do they just show up, or is there some evaluation process?
Housing-wise, we do have an application process due to the housing-wise, but more so people just show up. You know, our office is open from 8 to 5, but we meet a lot of people in the institutions. Like I say, we serve 14 institutions a month throughout the state of North Dakota. So that's in the jails, speaking to the men and women, and we on to the next. And I'm talking about we go as far as Dickinson. And so we meet people where they at. We give out our cards everywhere. We leave our flyers everywhere in lobbies, in jails, and you name it, social service buildings, anywhere. We want FI to be out there. We want to let them know that, hey, it's somebody out there that understand what you're going through, and we're willing to meet you where you are.
What do you expect of participants?
I just expect somebody to just be ready for accountability, somebody that's ready for change, somebody that won't change. You know, I try not to put the expectations too high on someone because I know the journey that they're going through. I understand his life. So I just encourage them to be ready.
Do you have to turn some people away?
Yes and no. You know, it's certain qualifications that a person have to have to reside in one of our houses due to the fact that we are renting. But more so, it's hard. That's one of the hardest things to do is turn somebody away when they come through our office and or reach out to us through phone or email or things like that. We just want to say, hey, man, what's up? You know, because if I ain't got the answers in our office, what we like to do is utilize our resources as well.
How would you describe the challenges facing somebody who's coming out of prison after a long time and trying to transition back into, you know, the greater society? You've done it a few times.
Yes.
So what are the toughest things to do?
Asking for help. That's one of the toughest things you can do. I speak for myself when I say that because I was released from prison before, and it was hard to just have to call and rely on somebody for either a ride or things like that.
What do you get when you get out of prison? Do they give you a little traveling money?
It depends. I was in Minnesota. So Minnesota, they got what they call a gate fee, and that's 10% of your earned income money or either the money that's sent in to you, they take out of your account and put it to a account that you can't touch until you're released. And it's a certain level it go up to depending on your time. So I was fortunate to have $500 saved up in that account, you know what I mean, plus anything else I was decided to leave with. So it kind of help a person get started, but you got to think, say if a person get released right now and it's cold, you know, $500 don't go too far. You can get boots, a coat, gloves, hats, And now you're back at square one.
So is there some stigma here? I mean, you've got some other things to do, too. You need to find a job.
Yeah. And hey, we meet with HRs from a lot of different organizations. There's a lot of organizations out here that second chance opportunity employers. So we try to meet them. We go sit down with HRs or organizations, and, you know, we try to get them to understand that, hey, this is our community. These guys that's coming out of jails, out of prisons, out of treatment, out of rehab, they are our community. So the best way to help our community succeed is to give a person another chance.
When you're in prison, are there programs or opportunities there to better prepare yourself for getting out?
Absolutely, absolutely. In Minnesota, for sure, they got all type of vocational classes, programs. They got welding. You can be a certified welder. They got A-plus computers where you can learn Microsoft Teams and all those type of things. So the opportunity is there, but person ready to do it.
There's a cultural impression of prison. You know, it's been on TV. Lots of movies have been made about it. Is prison a dangerous place?
It could be. Anywhere can be dangerous. With prison, if you go up in there with the mentality that you want to be involved in some dangerous stuff, then that's what you're going to get.
So does it sort of divide up into groups that are of like mind? Is that what happens?
Yeah, you get some guys that just say, hey, you know, they're going to do the time and not let the time do them. So they want to get involved with certain things that you shouldn't get involved with. You know what I mean? And I myself take credit for that, because I was involved in certain things that I shouldn't have been involved with while I was there. But it was a flip side to it. I had to understand, like, Leonard, doing this now is what you're going to do later. So if you decide to do something different now, that's what you're going to do something different later. And I involved myself in a lot of things. I got certificates for drywall. I'm forklift operator certified. I did chemical dependency treatment, parenting class, thinking for a change. And I completed all these classes, anger management, you name it.
So when you go to apply for a job, do they still ask that question? Do you have a criminal history?
It's asked. The box is still on the application. Yes, it is. And, you know, I was taught to just be honest with them. You know what I mean? If you can give me an opportunity to explain myself, explain what I want to do in my life right now, I think we got a better shot at it.
You think it limits the kinds of jobs that former inmates can get?
Yes, it do. And that's one of the reasons why us at F5, we make it our business to go out there and meet with employers and things like that to say, hey, you know, because you can Google my name right now on the internet and all type of stuff will come up. But that's not who I am today.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, when the state of North Dakota, the state of Minnesota, other states, and the federal government have been looking at prison policies, and they've been changing them with the idea of reducing the prison population and maybe making this transition work better, what would you recommend?
I agree. You know, I recommend more treatments. I recommend more housing, you know what I mean, development, so that guys, men and women, because that's one of the biggest stress levels, housing and employment. If we can catch those two right at the door, then I think we got a better chance of lessening the recidivism.
Jen, how did you get interested in F5? What brought you to this project?
You know, I was looking for a job, and I mean, you know, it's just one of those things that kind of happened. I met Adam. I was fortunate enough to have a mutual contact, and I met him and kind of talked to him a little bit about his story, and it really made sense to me. And, you know, some of the struggles that he was telling me about, how, you know, people coming out from jail and prison, they can't find a place to live. They can't find a job. But yet we expect them to, you know, turn their life around and move forward. Well, you know, sometimes people need a little bit of help. And the biggest thing that sold me on F5 is that F5 is not a place that does it for you. F5 is a place that says, here are the tools, but you need to come and use them. It's full accountability. You've got to want it. You've got to want it enough to get it for yourself. We'll be there to help you every step of the way. And that's probably the biggest reason that I jumped on board with F5.
Leonard, is this nonprofit F5 project doing something the state should be doing, or is it augmenting the parole process?
Oh, I think everybody should be doing it. Honestly, you know, I'm not here to criticize the state. You know, I appreciate the state. I got great relationships with parole, probation, the DOCR, because they was accepting to allowing a person like me with my background to come up in these places and encourage the men and women in there that you can do something different with yourself. So I got to salute the state for that one, because they could have easily said, Leonard, you know, been in prison 5 times. I was actually going into jails and institutions on parole. And the state agreed to allow me to do that, because So I take that as they ready for change. They want to help as well.
Okay. Well, you also have these other events coming up. December 7th, from 11 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon, a business coaching day. What happens there?
So part of F5, one of the programs that we offer is a CEO course. And what it is it's a course designed for people that are exiting the system. And it's designed to teach you how to be the CEO of your own life. You know, the course has so many different topics, from entrepreneurship to job skills to interpersonal skills to resume writing. And it's a 7-month course. And on this Saturday, December 7th, we are having a coaching day where we're having volunteers from the community who are either, you know, currently employed or entrepreneurs themselves. And they're going to sit down with our participants, and we're going to go through our participants' job pitches and get feedback. So it's kind of a, you know, let's go over where you're at, where you want to be, and get feedback from successful people in the community.
Is it possible to get hired on the spot?
I don't know. We'll find out.
Okay. And then the last Sunday of every month, from 5 to 6:30, there is a community meeting. Tell us about that, Leonard.
Our community meeting is just it's a time and place where we can all get together. That's including the residents, the past and the present residents that's in our program, the support from the community. I'm talking about you can bring family, friends, anybody. We done seen people walking past, going home and say, hey, come join us. You know, we just want to show our appreciation to the community for supporting us.
Now, is this your mission now, Leonard? I mean, what's your long-term view of Leonard Wells?
Man, so I got asked that question yesterday, and they say, what do I see it? I say, I just want to see F5 go global.
Uh-huh.
I just want to see F5, because I'm from Chicago, but I was raised in Minneapolis. So it's only right that I feel like it's an F5 should be in Minneapolis, F5 should be in Chicago. But not only that, Houston, New York as well.
So is this really a unique project, or are there sort of variations of this elsewhere around the country?
You know, we can't be duplicate. You know, not to toot our own horn. It is other organizations out there that do some similar things. You know what I mean? But like I say, we serve in 14 institutions a month.
Well, it's an organization that was put together by a former inmate to serve former inmates. So maybe there's an understanding there that is unique to that experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So when you do look long-term, Leonard, you know, 10 years down the road, what do you see yourself doing?
Oh, man. Wow. I know the kids will be gone. They'll be done with college.
There you go.
You know, I'd love to be able to take some extra vacations, you know. But I got a service to do right now. So right now I'm just focused on today and we're seeing what tomorrow going
to
bring.
I went online to the F5project.org website, which has a fair amount of information. It includes a blog, which has a little audio conversation that you participate in sometimes with Adam Martin.
Yes, sir.
And so you're sharing your story and some ideas for the organization.
That's just our way of being intimate with the community. You know, we got a great fan base through F5, through Facebook. So that's one of our ways is just giving back, letting them know we being intimate, letting them know we are here, we human. You know, we go through struggles and trials and tribulations, but this is who we are.
Now, when I went up there, I came across something called the Five Pillars.
Yeah.
And that was communication, housing, employment, healthy socialization, and transportation. You touched on these things when we started this discussion.
Absolutely.
So these are pretty important elements for somebody who's making that transition for somebody tells me what to do every day all the time to now I have my life back.
Right. And yeah, those five pillars, they're important because those are some of the things right there that can keep somebody potentially from going back to jail. If we can help serve those areas right there, we're in a great space.
So does F5 have any track record yet? I mean, I know it's a relatively new organization, but can you point to recidivism rates or success stories, that kind of thing?
Yeah, a little bit. So we do have, as of today, if we have a participant living in one of our houses for 6 months or longer, 0% recidivism rate.
Wow.
As of today, yes.
So and this is people who showed up and needed help and were invited in.
Yes, it's people that came in, filled out the application with Leonard, got in a house, and stayed for at least 6 months.
All right. Yep. So how big is this organization now?
Oh, wow. Like I said, we had 26 employees right now.
29, actually.
29, actually. I can remember just January. It was three of us in the office. Now it's seven. in our office right now. So we growing, man. Every day it's something new, you know.
And obviously the need is there to get bigger.
Absolutely. You know, a person won't even understand the need until they experience it themselves. Like, we out there, we going out there, we going to meet people where they at, and we starting to really see, like, it's a need, so we're going to keep going.
Well, a couple of years ago, Adam Martin was in the news because one of the houses he was using was, you know, filled with former inmates, and some of the neighbors were upset about that, and there was talk about it. But that seems to have gone by the wayside. And Adam Martin is seen on stage with the governor and the first lady recently, you know, at Recovery Reinvented. And he seems to have some important connections for the organization. How would you describe him as a leader?
He's a wise man, man. I always refer to him as a wise man when I talk about him, you know what I mean? And as a leader, man, I think he's great. You know, he love to think. He's a person that think. And he don't just react off impulse. He think about it. He'll break it down. You know, I learned a lot from him. I asked a lot of questions. You know what I mean? He's a good man. He's a brother of mine.
Well, this organization has grown quickly. You've had some experience in other cities, and you say this thing should be tried elsewhere. Is there any putting together kind of a model to share with other people, or how would the F5 project go someplace else?
We just going to keep grinding. You know, we live by this model called hustle. You know what I mean? As long as we keep hustling the right way, I know we're going to make it not only out of the state of North Dakota, but into other states as well.
So how important is this fundraiser in January, Jen?
This is going to be our first ever yearly event that we're going to start. So, I mean, this is going to set the tone for future events, and this is something that we hope to keep going for years to come.
So you need some people to show up.
Absolutely need people to show up.
It's on the 12th of January from 5 to 9. It's at the Avalon Event Center. There's a dinner, a silent auction, raffles, and speakers and testimony.
Yes.
So how many people would you like to see?
I would like to see at least 200 people show up. Mm-hmm. That would be fantastic.
And how much does the event cost?
So tickets, single tickets are $50 a piece, or you can purchase a table which holds 8 people for $450. Otherwise, any of the sponsorship levels include your seat for free.
And how are advanced sales going?
You know, pretty well. We've sold 2 tables already and I believe 8 tickets.
Well, will you be offering some testimony, Leonard?
No, we got some other speakers this time. I did it last time. So,
well, you have been doing speaking, though.
Yeah, you know, it don't stop. I was told that I talk a little too much.
Well, that works fine on radio. Well, do you like sharing your story?
I love it.
I mean, because there are some bumps in your road.
I love sharing my story, you know, because, you know, we got a lot of people that can relate. You know what I mean? I am an open book about who I am, where I come from. By me sharing my story, it encourages others that, hey, you can have a past and don't let that past define you. So I don't mind sharing it at all.
Well, thanks for coming here and sharing it with our listeners on Main Street.
Thanks for having me.
Leonard Wells is a reentry peer support person and a housing director and a care coordinator for the F5 project in Fargo. Jen Troska, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Jen is the director of development for the F5 project. Again, more information at f5project.org. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing Valley City Barnes County Development Corporation, North Dakota recipient of the 2019 Bush Prize for Community Innovation. Learn more about the 2019 Bush Prize winners at bushfoundation.org/bushprize.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 3rd. In the early days, when the eastern states were still colonies of Great Britain, farmers were bound by the doctrine of common law. Farmers who owned animals that were likely to roam, like cattle or horses, were responsible for any damage done by those animals. This made fencing necessary to keep animals in, as opposed to fencing grain or vegetable acres to keep animals out. This rule came from England and made sense in densely populated areas. It didn't make sense, however, for the vast expanse of the Great Plains. Consequently, states and territories began enacting laws that were more workable. In its early days, for example, Montana adopted the open range doctrine, allowing a rancher to let his animals roam, leaving it up to his neighbors to fence the animals out.
Much of the grazing land was owned by the government and used in common by many ranchers, so it was impossible to erect fencing. In addition, fencing the limited cropland was less expensive than fencing extensive tracts of rangeland. On this date in 1904, the Washburn Leader reminded readers about North Dakota's herd laws. By 1904, the state had become more populated and expectations had changed. From April through December, ranchers now faced limits on allowing livestock to run loose. Those months provided time for the growing season and the harvest. But from December through April, the animals were allowed to roam, and all hay and other property had to be protected by a legal fence. The fence had to be made of substantial posts no further apart than 32 feet. There had to be two smaller stays between the main posts, and the fence had to have three wires, with the top one at least 42 inches above the ground. If such a fence was not in place, the rancher could not be held responsible for any damage done by his animals. Today, North Dakota honors a mix of common law and the open range doctrines. There are still areas where livestock is allowed to roam, but in other areas, ranchers are responsible for any damage done by their animals. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck and dedicated to producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind projects in North and South Dakota.
A jellyfish sculpted from golf balls, a sea dragon made of suction cups. On the Oregon coast, a local artist is using plastic garbage that washes ashore to raise awareness about ocean pollution.
I want to reach everybody. I want to reach people who might throw something on the beach and not think about it, and I want to make them start to think about it.
Turning waste into art on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, we'll talk with Byron Dorgan about his new book, The Girl in the Photograph, the true story of a Native American child lost and found in America. Tom Eastern will voice a Plainsfolk essay titled The Human Race in 8,000 Words. And Bill Law will join us to talk about how World War I brought jazz to the wider world. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.